this seemed like a good idea at the time. For the first time in history, people willing to risk their sanity thinking about fundamental problems in quantum theory would be afforded the lavish support they needed to pursue their passion without having to work in a soup kitchen or pretend that they weren't really working on something else. And so, alongside string theory, quantum information, quantum gravity, and cosmology, the PI Quantum Foundations Group was formed. All this seemed to be going very well. But then, about 2 years ago, we realized that it was not well in the Garden of Eden. The primary problem was about finding jobs for postdocs, but this was a symptom of a much bigger problem. Ideally, a smart student should be able to, without fear or embarrassment, make quantum foundations the core area of his or her doctoral studies. They should be able to then find a few postdoctoral fellowships and finally, in the way of academia, secure a good faculty position. We realized that we could not do this alone. Howard, in typical Howard style, decided that we needed to change the world. He called a meeting, which was held at 10 Merton Street in Oxford, a building I'm sure some of you know, in England, and people, Harvey Brown and Roger Penrose, amongst the people here today who were at the meeting. We discussed strategies to make this changing of the world happen. And since then, promoting quantum foundations outside the boundaries of this building has become and remains a very firm goal of this institute. Shortly after this meeting, Howard traveled to Australia and found there many people who were very receptive to these ideas. After extensive discussions with Hugh Price, Peter Bacigalupi, Steve Bartlett, Howard Wiseman, and Gerald Milburn, amongst others, the PF collaboration was born. So PF is a collaboration between the Perimeter Institute and three Australian universities, Griffith, Sydney, and Queensland. The collaboration is funded in roughly equal measure by Perimeter Institute and the Australian universities. And it does three things. First, there's a visitor exchange program. Second, four postdoctoral positions have been created. And third, a series of workshops and conferences are to be held. Because all this is in the spirit of trying to stimulate interest and growth in the field of quantum foundations. The first PF workshop was held last February in Sydney and was, I think, a tremendous success. And this is the first PF conference. It's about time, which I'm out of. So welcome to the first conference in the PF collaboration, The Clock and the Quantum. It's a conference about time in quantum foundations. And who better to kick us off than somebody who doesn't believe that it exists?
Ginny Bartlett is going to talk about the theory of clocks and
thank you very much. At the back? You can hear, yeah? And, yeah, it's fine, thank you. It's a great privilege to be here in Perimeter for the first time and to hear about all this exciting support that they're giving. Can you read that, or should we try having the house lights a bit dimmer? They're coming down. I apologize that I've got some writing on it, which may not be quite as legible as the other. The house lights seem to be getting brighter, if anything. Anyway, let me emphasize that today I shall be talking about classical non-relativistic theory for a dynamically closed universe. I should be talking about classical relativistic theory on Wednesday in the colloquium at 2 p.m. And I do have quantum conjectures, and I emphasize their conjectures, and you can find them in my book, The End of Time, or in papers cited on my website, platonia.com. So much for that start. Now, an overview of the talk. I'm going to start with historical antecedents, And in many ways, the most interesting one for talking about a theory of duration is the moon's anomalous acceleration, which came to light in the 1890s and caused a lot of headaches for astronomers and theoreticians. On the basis of the solution that the astronomers found to this problem, I shall then develop a theory of duration and clocks in the non-relativistic context. And that will be probably take up half of my talk. If there's time, and I would then like to go on to discuss the idea of internal time, which has been sort of spooking around in quantum gravity for over 50 years. I think it's a bad idea, and I want to explain why I think it's a bad idea. And finally, again, if there's time, I shall talk about determining not only time, but an inertial frame of reference in a very neat little bit of work which Tate did in 1883. So that's the sort of overview. Now, historical antecedents. In ancient Greek astronomy, they developed, Hipparchus and Ptolemy developed really quite good, I would say, dynamical theories of the motion of the planets and the moon. They were laws. They had laws that described the motions of the moon. And they were sufficiently good to be able to predict eclipses of the moon quite well. And a key element in this was the idea of uniform motion. The moon was assumed to move on certain circles uniformly. And how could that be made meaningful with respect to what was this uniform motion? And it's very interesting that Ptolemy, in his Almagest, written in about 150 AD, makes a very clear choice as to what is the standard of time, because there were two choices that the astronomers could have made, and the more obvious one was the civil one by the sun. When the sun is south, that's midday. And the sun is by far the most prominent thing in the sky. So it would have been natural to assume that uniformity of motion was determined by uniformity of the motion of the sun. The alternative was that it was the rotation of the stars, sidereal time. And it's very interesting, there's an absolutely clear statement in Ptolemy's Almagest that you must take the stars and not the sun as the measure of time. And he essentially describes what the astronomers today call the equation of time. Sidereal time differs from solar time by an average of 4 minutes a day. That's just because of the Earth going around the sun. But there's a more subtle difference, which arises from two causes. First of all, the blue curve, this one here, is due to Kepler's second law. When the Earth is further from the sun, it moves slower than when it's closer to the sun. And that causes a shift between sidereal time and solar time, mean solar time. And then there's another one, which is due to the obliquity of the ecliptic. When the sun is in the summer solstice or the winter solstice, it's moving due east along the ecliptic. But when at the equinoxes, it's moving north-south. So it's not moving as fast east. And the two effects combined lead to the equation of time, which is the total effect is essentially a maximum of 15 minutes either side discrepancy. And that's quite enough to put out the accuracy of your predictions of lunar eclipses. Newton, you will know, of course, said that time flows uniformly, absolute time flows uniformly without reference to anything else. But he does make some very interesting comments, very brief in the Principia. He says, it may be that there is no such thing as an equable motion whereby time may be accurately measured. Duration ought to be distinguished from what are only sensible measures thereof and from which we deduce it by means of the astronomical equation, by which he means the equation of time, which had recently been redetermined by the first astronomer royal. So Newton was perfectly clear that a good measure of time had got to be got somehow from observation of things moving. But if you read the Principia, it's also quite clear that he had some sort of theological notion of abstract duration, something that persists, and I guess he would associate that with the existence of God. And it also reminds me of Feynman's quip, time is what happens when nothing else does. Now, the first person, as far as I know, who seriously tried to make sense of Newton's ideas about time was the mathematician Carl Neumann, who wrote a booklet in 1870, and he introduced the notion of an inertial clock. He said it's meaningless to say that one motion by itself is uniform. You've got nothing to compare it with. But he says, let me take one particle moving uniformly. If I can see space, Newton's absolute space, let me grant me that, he says, and I can see the particle moving inertially, force-free, and be sure that that's the case, I can then use the distance that particle travels to be one measure of time, and then I can see if another particle is moving uniformly by that measure of time. So comparison of motions is crucial in that. And that actually is an important insight, I think, and it's surprising how late these things came. Now to the really started things going, and that's the anomalous acceleration of the moon. In the 1890s, they found that the moon was accelerating, apparently, going faster than it should. And there were two possible causes of this lunar anomaly. One of them, which was taken very seriously, was that gravity is absorbed by the Earth at eclipses of the moon, so that the gravity of the sun is weaker, is acting more weakly on the moon in an eclipse, and that this was the cause of the acceleration. And this theory was actually still seriously considered until 1937, when it was finally abandoned. The other one, which the astronomers thought was much more likely, was that their clock was not in order. And let me remind you that there was one unique clock for astronomy for 2.5 millennia, and that was the rotation of the Earth, sidereal time. And they thought that probably the cause of this problem was that the rotation of the Earth was irregular. Now, of course, that's been confirmed beyond any shadow of doubt. But in the 1890s, because they didn't have atomic clocks, and pendula were no good, were not of sufficient accuracy to do it, it was only a conjecture. So then they said, well, if the Earth is not a reliable clock, how are we going to define time? And they hit on the following idea. They said, let us suppose that the solar system is governed by Newton's laws. Let us choose the time parameter to measure duration so that Newton's laws are confirmed, that the solar system does obey Newton's laws with respect to that choice of the time. And in particular, the total energy of the solar system must be conserved according to this measure of time. And this they originally called Newtonian time, and then later it was called ephemeris time because it was deduced from the table of positions of the celestial bodies. And the key point here is that a dynamical theory was used to convert a mere labeling of time into a metric of time. So that's the key thing. You've got to get a metric of time, and the way you do it is by using a dynamical theory. So that's the key point, the dynamical theory. And now in 1898, there's a very interesting paper that Poincaré published where he drew attention to two problems with time. The first one, he said, there's been a lot of discussion about, and he refers to the astronomers' discussion. And he says that there is the great problem. What is it? How can you meaningfully say that a second today is the same as a second tomorrow? And he then proceeds to explain the solution that the astronomers had given. But he then said, there's another problem. How do you define simultaneity at spatially separated points? And he said, not so many people have noticed this. And 7 years later, as everybody knows, Einstein and Minkowski had this daring treatment of simultaneity, which caused an absolute sensation. And as far as I can see, it completely eclipsed interest in duration. If you look in books on dynamics, more or less anywhere that I've looked, I've failed to find any satisfactory theory of duration. Seems to me a remarkable lack of interest. People talk about cyclic processes and so on, but it's not a proper thing. Now, Poincaré, actually, I'll go on to this. Poincaré had his conventionalist philosophy, which I think was a bad mistake, and he said that actually the astronomer's solution was only a convenient one, but there was nothing ultimately forcing you to it. You could choose other measures of time, and they would be less convenient. I'm going to argue that Poincaré, I'll get it right, was wrong about that. Now I want to give this a more formal theory than this qualitative one that the astronomers gave. And I want to talk about a concept of a complete universe. Take, for example, n particles in Euclidean space. They will have a configuration space, which is represented here. This is Q. And then the normal representation that you have in Newtonian dynamics is there's a space of absolute times. This is the space of absolute time. And you see these trajectories are nicely rising with respect to absolute time. This is indicating that time is passing in the Newtonian picture. And in this picture, if you specify a point and a direction, then that gives you a unique history in Newtonian theory. If you take away the information about time, you find that all of these things can start off at the same point and the same direction and then diverge. That's because they've got different total energy. And this is actually all that you're objectively given. If, say, some god or an angel could see these particles instantaneously, each of their successive positions, all that they would act, and I'm assuming they can see absolute space, all they would see and record is this curve. Because everything, beg your pardon? Sure. Well, no, sorry, that really would be two dimensions of space. It's not a, I should have been a bit clearer about that, yes. And of course, actually, for an n particle system, it's a 3n dimensional configuration space. I need more dimensions. Thank you for the question. If you actually just say an experimentalist must record what's observed, those curves are all there are. There isn't this extra space here. You can't put that in because every single motion that you would use to get at this T, as Newton recognized, is actually somewhere recorded in those curves. It's in there. Now, what you can do, and what was done already by Jacobi in 1843, was to consider what these curves in the configuration space are like for different values of the energy. So here I'm plotting, this is actually phase space, I'm afraid I forgot to put it on here. These are curves on different energy surfaces, total energy surfaces in phase space. So the key thing I want to emphasize is that the history of the universe is not a curve traversed at some speed, but it's simply a curve in the configuration space. And furthermore, each point on the curve is an entire configuration of the universe and an instant of time. That, I think, is the right way to think about time classically. Now, Mach said, Ernst Mach in 1883 said, it is utterly impossible to measure the changes of things by time, much rather, time is an abstraction deduced from the changes of things. I've slightly, to fit that quotation onto this view graph, I've slightly mauled his words and shortened it a bit. Apologies to Mach for that. It's actually not 1843, I recently learned, but 1837, Jacobi gave the first mathematically correct formulation of the principle of least action. And it is actually here in this form before your eyes here. It's a variational principle which determines the orbit of a dynamical system in its configuration space without any reference to a speed at which this happens. It's the planetary ellipses, for example. And it's a geodesic principle, and it's normally today written in this form, where you introduce a parameter. I showed you those curves in, on there. So that parameter lambda is just any arbitrary parameter with no idea that it's a meaningful time. So this is just lambda along the curve there. And as you see, it's got a very characteristic square root, which makes it a geodesic principle. Interestingly, Jacobi formulated it without the lambda in, as I say, it's in 1837, not 1843. That was the book I got it from. This actually defines, that part, the kinetic part, defines a flat metric on the configuration space, but the capital E is the total energy and V is the potential energy. That's a conformal factor which makes it into a Riemannian geometry on the configuration space. And there was a lot of work already started in the second half of the 19th century by Lipschitz and Abou, and it continues into this century, whereby n-body specialists almost always work on a constant energy surface so that they can exploit Riemannian geometry. And it's very interesting, there's a big cultural difference between relativists who geometrize into space-time and n-body specialists who geometrize into the configuration space. And I think a lot of the confusions and problems in the problem of time in quantum gravity, canonical quantum gravity, arise from lack of knowledge of Jacobi's principle. Now, if you take Jacobi's principle and calculate the canonical momenta, they have a very characteristic and unfamiliar form. They don't look at all first class like the Newtonian momenta. The Newtonian momenta would be just this bit here, mi dxi by d lambda. By the way, I hope that is coming out clearly when I point with it. Yes, it seems to be. Now, just have a look at the structure of this thing. If you ignore the part that's the energy and the potential, this is something very much like a direction cosine. This is essentially the hypotenuse of the displacement in the configuration space. So this is the displacement of each individual particle divided by the total displacement and weighted by the masses. So this is actually very like direction cosines, which is what you want in a timeless theory. The initial condition in a geodesic is not an initial point and an initial speed at that point. It's just an initial point and a direction at that point. And you would specify that naturally by direction cosines. And if you square direction cosines and add them up, you get unity. And the same thing happens here. You have this constraint here, which is very characteristic and is very closely analogous to the Hamiltonian constraint in general relativity. And the equations of motion are here. Now, if you look at that equation, it stands out. There's one unique choice that you will want to make, which to simplify that equation, and this is to choose t equal to e minus v. And in that way, you recover Newton's law. And then you have this expression, which is actually the astronomer's ephemeris time. Here it is, the increment of their ephemeris time is precisely given by this explicit expression here. And that's, I think, a very satisfying, and it is ultimately, I believe, the correct definition of duration. And it comes straight out of a very simple theory. And Mach, I think, was quite right to say that the thing that comes first is the changes of positions. I'm moving here. That's the objective thing. And what this is telling you is that if you contemplate all of the motions of everything in this dynamically closed universe, that gives you a sensible measure of time. Now, let me go on and say, because this is actually even more persuasive when you go into some details. Poincaré, I said, thought that you didn't have to choose that ephemeris time, but I think you have no sensible alternative. I think the choice of how you define time and how you define clocks is as unique as, say, Boltzmann's definition of entropy. I did, in a way, I'd like to dedicate this talk to the memory of Bryce DeWitt, with whom I had the honor to have several very nice discussions, and I have the greatest respect for Bryce, but on the question of clocks, I could never get him to see sense, if I may say so. I used to ask Bryce, what is the definition of a clock? And his answer was, it's any device that the National Bureau of Standards tells me keeps time to a satisfactory accuracy. To which I would say, but Bryce, you're the theoretician, you should be telling them, not asking them. And I would say the first thing is, if you're going to have a clock, you must know what it is the clock has to measure, and it has to measure duration. And the definition of duration is the theoretician's task. Then, as Clements, if you look in the Reviews of Modern Physics 1957, that contains the North Carolina proceedings with Everett's famous paper on the many worlds interpretation, you'll find a very nice article by Clements at the start of that issue called Astronomical Time, which I do recommend. And he makes the point, he says that a clock is any dynamical system that marches in step with ephemeris time, and it must be marching in step with ephemeris time if it measures duration, as I've put there. But he doesn't go on to make this point, which I think is key, which is that two clocks must march in step if they're going to be any use. Why do we have clocks and watches? It's so that we can meet each other if we want to at a definite time. If you've chosen a la Poincaré to define, use a clock that's different from my one, we will not meet when we agree to. So you can forget any idea that is based on such shaky foundations. Now just imagine two solar systems separate, widely separated in space, both dynamically isolated, and you send two teams of astronomers to each of these systems, and they've got to generate time signals and from the motions that they observe in these systems to a third party here. And when those time signals arrive, they must march in step. They can come in at different frequencies, the bip, bip, bips of their time that they're sending, but they mustn't, the frequency mustn't shift relative to each other. And that's a very tight requirement. And if you think about it for a bit, there is essentially only one time you can choose. Each of these things must determine the ephemeris time for each of these subsystems and then send the signal in accordance with that way. And in that way, you will get the time signals to march in step. Now, it's interesting that if they tried to take the total action of the system, it would be completely useless, because the action is the product of the kinetic energy and essentially the potential energy. And when the potential energy gets very large and negative in a gravitating system, the motions speed up. So that if this system is going down deep into its potential well and that one's rising up out of it, if you tried to measure time by the action, which you might think is the more natural thing to do, this clock would go far faster than this one. They would march out of step. But the joy about ephemeris time is that putting the E minus V down in the denominator exactly offsets that. So there's a beautiful balancing. If this goes down into its potential well and all its parts are moving faster, it's offset by that potential factor and keeps in step with that one there. And that's, to my mind, that's the miracle of Newtonian dynamics. And I think it's a very beautiful fact. And it is, I think, what makes that the unique choice of both the definition of duration and time. So let me just summarize that part of the talk by this view graph. Let me also point out that there is, in principle, no truly isolated system in the universe. So a dynamically closed universe is its own unique clock. And here's the expression for it. You've seen it already. Every mass in the universe contributes, and no truly isolated subsystems exist. And I will just mention, it seems to me inescapable that quantum processes must be governed by this time and not some other thing. I can't believe that out there in the universe there's some other motion which is governing the speed at which clocks go. It's conceivable, but I can't really imagine that that happens. Let me also make the point, which for me is a very important one, and this could kill my ideas about the nature of time, is that this theory of time presupposes space. I've got to be able to know about the distance everybody has moved relative to everybody else before I can calculate this quantity. And let me remind you of this wonderful saying of Galileo, he that attempts natural philosophy without geometry is lost. I think it's absolutely essential to have something which holds the world together and enables you to speak meaningfully about what is happening in the entire universe. And I think that the basis of everything is well, unless string theory is right and we live in a universe with 10 dimensions, I'm assuming there's just three. It's three-dimensional geometry, which I believe is the key to everything. So that's the theory of duration. Lucien, when should we be stopping? I think I've probably got about another 20 minutes, have I? Yeah, something about that, yeah. No, I look as if I'm on. I started at about 10 past, and I meant to go for 3/4 of an hour, so that would mean stop at 5:02, yeah. I think I'll be comfortably there. Now, I want to go on to the notion of internal time in canonical quantum gravity and remind you of a theory which is called parametrized particle dynamics. Here's the Newtonian, the standard Newtonian action. And in parametrized particle dynamics, which has been around, I think, for getting on for a century, I don't know who first introduced the idea, but it was certainly around in the 20s. The idea is to add the Newtonian time as an extra degree of freedom to the ordinary degrees of freedom, the positions of the particles. So you make T another one. So you have now a configuration space which is QT, but this is not an external absolute framework. It's another degree of freedom for which you're going to get an equation of motion. And then you have a curve of the system which is now in this enlarged space QT, and you parametrize it by an arbitrary parameter lambda, hence the expression parametrized particle dynamics. And you rewrite the Newtonian action in this form here. And you'll see it's got a very, now the primes denote the derivative with respect to lambda. And this is essentially the Newtonian action, but now the T, this is T bar, where the velocities are calculated with this arbitrary lambda. And then you've got the velocity of time, which is dt by d lambda. And lots of people get very excited about this. Dirac loved this theory. It figures prominently in his lectures on quantum mechanics. The action is invariant under reparametrization. And this is thought to be wonderful, an illustration of what a generally covariant system is. Here are the canonical momenta. And I have to say, it looks to me a very odd system. The geometrical, the positions of the particles are held together by geometry. Time is something completely heterogeneous added into this. It's not held together like the other ones are. Time is unified with the other degrees of freedom only in that the variation is done in the same way. It's not done in the same way as regards what you're actually talking about. And I would like to introduce the concept that one should be a disease that theoreticians should be very aware of, which I call generalitis. How many papers do you read in theoretical physics which start, we consider a general dynamical system with n degrees of freedom, q1 to qn, and then we add the time and call it qn plus 1. And nobody ever stops and says, what do these things actually mean? What are we talking about? And I think this is a disease, and itis does mean an infection and an itch. So that's generalitis, I think. And I think anybody who stopped and looked at the way the velocity of time appears in, say, would say this is some interloper that doesn't belong here. It stands out as well because it's a cyclic coordinate. Its velocity appears, but the time itself does not. So it stands completely apart from the other ones here. Now, because it's reparametrization invariant, you get a constraint which is very like the one in Jacobi's principle, except that the velocity of the momentum of time occurs linearly here. That's the quadratic part that you have in Jacobi's principle. That's the potential there. And you get that extra one there. And there was this fateful remark, if you read the Arnowitz-Deser-Misner paper, and I don't want in any way to underestimate the great importance of that paper, they say explicitly, in possessing this covariance, they point out that general relativity is reparametrization invariant. And they say it's already parametrized, and then comes the statement, in possessing this covariance, general relativity is precisely analogous to the parametrized form of dynamics, in which the Hamiltonian and time are introduced as a conjugate pair of variables of a new degree of freedom. I think this was a disastrous mistake. I'm sorry if any of the three gentlemen are here. I apologize, because the rest of the stuff is tremendous what they did. But I think this was just, I think it actually comes about because nobody working in relativity that I've come across, I used to give lectures and ask relativists, 30, who had heard of Jacobi's principle? And I would get perhaps one person raising their hand and not knowing what it looked like. And it just, it's this difference of cultures that was just not known. And I think if people had Jacobi's principle in their bones, they wouldn't have thought of such a suggestion. But this then led on to the idea, you see, the point that they made is here, when you try and quantize general relativity, you get the Wheeler de Witt equation, and there doesn't seem to be any time in it. So the idea was that in parametrized particle dynamics, time is sitting in there, you've added it in, and if only you look carefully enough within general relativity, you could find a time just like the time in parametrized particle dynamics, which is actually an absolute Newtonian time in disguise. So the idea was to recover some sort of time with respect to which you could do a time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And that has always seemed to me a very misguided idea. Now, let me just give you a few facts and show you what sort of candidate times you could get. And let me just give you just a few facts of mathematics about the Newtonian n-body problem. First of all, a very key concept is the moment of inertia about the center of mass of the system. That's here. That's the normal definition you find, but Leibniz found a very beautiful representation of that, which is very Machian, purely in terms of the separations between the particles. That's the moment of inertia about that. Now, the behavior of this in Newtonian mechanics has special behavior if the potential is homogeneous of some degree k in these separations. But I shouldn't have put that there, I should have put it a bit later. This is first of all just straight differentiation of the expression for the moment of inertia. This is the second derivative with respect to Newtonian time or ephemerist time. That's just an identity. Now you can use Newton's second law and the definition of t to rewrite that in this form here. Now this is where the homogeneity comes in. By Euler's theorem for homogeneous functions, we have this relation here. And if you, in addition, use again the expression for the energy, we obtain what's known as the Lagrange-Jacobi relation, which is here, which depends upon k. So it's relating the second derivative of the moment of inertia to the total energy and the potential and this homogeneity degree. Now, in celestial mechanics, k is equal to minus 1, and v is negative. And in this case, the second derivative of the moment of inertia is this quantity. And because this is negative, that must be positive if e is bigger than 0 or equal to 0. So the second derivative of the moment of inertia is positive if the total energy is greater than or equal to 0. And this means that the behavior of the moment of inertia goes like this in time. Here's time along here. It starts up here somewhere. it's decreasing, goes through a minimum, and then goes back up again to a maximum. And it tends to infinity. It cannot avoid tending to infinity. And this means that any Newtonian celestial mechanical system with energy equal to or greater than zero must be unstable. This is the first qualitative result obtained in dynamics, and it was found by Lagrange. And it's also related to the virial theorem there. If the system is virialized, for example, so that the rate of change of the moment of inertia is zero, as more or less in a globular cluster, for example, then you get some relationship between the energy and the kinetic energy, the total energy or the kinetic energy and the potential energy. Now, let's just go on and see what we can deduce from this. Now, are we going to find, have we got any chance of finding a good internal time? And the answer is precious little. If you just think about a typical star system, all the stars are just moving around relative to each other. They'll go backwards and forwards. You try and choose any, say, separation between two celestial objects, you won't even get a monotonic time. It'll go backwards and forwards. So time will start flowing backwards if you try to use that separation as the hand of a clock. And there's virtually no chance that you will get it to march in step with ephemeris time. So frankly, it's going to be useless. Now, there are some interesting special cases. If you take inertial motion, then you can take the potential equal to zero, and then E is greater than zero, and that relation, the Lagrange-Jacobi relation, just becomes this, and this says that the first derivative of the moment of inertia increases linearly with the time, so that the moment of inertia, the rate of change of the moment of inertia, is in this special case a good clock. But that's pretty trivial because we know from Neumann's idea that in any system of particles that are just moving inertially, any one of them will be a good clock. But note that the moment of inertia itself is not proportional to t. It has a quadratic dependence. So it's nonlinear and non-monotonic. Now, if you take Newtonian gravity, there is a very interesting thing. Again, in this situation where the energy is either zero or greater than zero, then you get this relationship, and I dot is monotonic, and it has a behavior like this. I dot is the derivative of that. It starts at minus infinity, and it goes on up to plus infinity. So that is actually a monotonic clock, but it is certainly not a good clock that marches in step with ephemeris time. And by the way, those of you who know about York time in general relativity, this is precisely analogous to what happens with York time. Now, there's an extremely interesting case when we have scale invariance. Now, I'll just say something about Machian ideas. Mach said, time is relative, motion is relative. A logical extension of that is that size is relative. And you can only have relativity of size in mechanics if the potential is homogeneous of degree minus 2. You can see that immediately in Jacobi's principle. The kinetic energy is has got the squares of the things, and in Jacobi's principle, it's just multiplied by E minus V. Now, and then you take the square root. Now, this is quadratic in length. So if you change the length scale, you'll change this quantity unless this thing is length to the minus 2. This, by the way, means that E, a constant there, cannot appear because that's not got length to the minus 2. So you actually have a device, if you insist on scale invariance, to kill the E and choose that the potential is V is length to the minus 2. And there's some very interesting things about such a theory. So that's it there. So if you have that, now first of all, you can still have such a potential and not do Jacobi's principle, but just do general Newtonian theory, where you still are allowed to have the energy equal to zero. In this case, you get the relation here for the rate of change of the moment of inertia, which is exactly the same as it is for inertial motion. Now this is really a very remarkable result. It is saying in this case, when there is an energy, that I dot is a good clock, although there are highly non-trivial interactions taking place in the system. This is a very remarkable result. Now, so that's a good internal clock, and it's highly non-trivial. But then, in a truly Muffian theory, as I've published in a paper, and I'll give details if anybody's interested, actually E must be equal to zero, but let's for the moment, and actually D will have to be zero as well, but let's just for the moment consider when E is equal to zero, then the moment of inertia takes this form, and that means that now the moment of inertia is a good clock. It marches in step, but the time derivative of the moment of inertia is stopped. So that clock that was very good, the York-type clock, has stopped. But then if both E and D are zero, and that is what happens, I believe, in an ideal Machian theory, which is scale invariant, then I stops as well. And in this case, there will be absolutely no good internal time. So I think that's also quite interesting. Now, I said that, are there any ladies present? In Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, the rude mechanicals worry if there will be anything that will fright the ladies, but I shall take a risk here. I've said once that time sticks out like a sore thumb. There is actually a somewhat more obscene way in which it can stand out. And in southern England, on a chalk hill, there is a huge carving of a naked giant. So I hope nobody will ever take the idea of internal time seriously again, and I hope this won't go against perimeter restrictions on what should go out, as this is being transmitted worldwide eventually. But just so that everybody forgets the idea of internal time, there's the Cerne Abbas giant carved in southern England, and his male member is as indecent, I believe, as the idea of internal time. Right, I've got 5 more minutes, so I'll just finish. I haven't said anything about how inertial systems could be got. When Neumann put his idea forward for an inertial clock, he said, I haven't yet worked out how to get an inertial frame of reference from observable things. And very interestingly, Lord Kelvin's brother, James Thompson, who I think was the very first person to point out that there may be some difficulty with defining simultaneity at spatially separated points. In 1883, he got Tait to think about how you could determine an inertial system if you had systems all moving inertially relative to each other. And that's actually a very interesting fact, which would make a lot of introductions to mechanics a little bit clearer if it was given. He supposes that you're given snapshots of 3 particles. He considers n particles, but you need 3 to at least. Suppose I'm given snapshots of particles, but I'm not shown absolute space. Can I, from a certain number of snapshots, asks Tait, conclude that these particles are moving rectilinearly and uniformly? Can I do anything with that? And the first thing he says is, let's do a count of the unknowns that we have in this. By Galilean relativity, we can always take particle 1 to be at the origin. So there's particle 1 at the origin. And then we can choose x and y coordinates in such a way that at time t equals 0, which we're free to choose, particle A is moving parallel to the y-axis, passes through the x-axis at distance A from particle 1. So that A is one unknown in the problem. That's one sort of, so to speak, physical unknown. I'm assuming that length is allowed. So particle 1 is here. Particle 2 has one unknown in it because I've said that it's going to move with unit speed. That's my choice of the time scale. And then particle 3 has arbitrary initial position and arbitrary initial velocity. So that's 6 things. So there are 7 unknowns that I must determine. So the problem has 7 unknowns. And each snapshot has 3 data, the 3 separations between the particles. but you don't know the time at which the snapshots are taken. So essentially, each snapshot has two data in it. So with four snapshots, you have eight data, and you only needed seven. So that's enough to determine an inertial system and to have one independent verification that these particles are indeed satisfying Newton's laws. Now, if you have large n, this is very interesting. So you need four snapshots for three particles. For large n, the number of unknowns is 6n minus 11. You can work that out. And each snapshot gives 3n minus 7 data. And therefore, two snapshots gives you 3n minus 14 data, and that's exactly three less than the number you needed. So this means, and this is going to be a central point of my talk on Wednesday, I call this the two and a bit problem. It is ultimately the evidence for absolute space, as I'll also point out. But essentially, it means that you need at least three snapshots to get initial data for Newtonian theory. So that's quite an interesting fact. It's a very neat bit of work that Tate did. And just as an indication of how lacking people who give lectures on dynamics are on the real foundations of the theory, there's a very interesting exchange in the proceedings of the 1955 Relativity Conference in Bern. I think Roger Penrose was there, were you not, Roger? Where's Roger? Yes. Were you there, Roger? The 55 conference for the 50th anniversary of special relativity. Where did you go? Anyway, that's at that conference, Felix Pirani gave a talk on reference frames in general relativity. And after it, Fokker said, how many particles would you need that are moving inertially to determine an inertial frame of reference so that with respect to those three, any other particle locally in a freely falling frame would be moving rectilinearly with respect to that frame. Because Fokker said that has got to be surely the ultimate content of Newton's first law. And Pirani answered, I don't know, but I would guess three, and then the fourth one, you'd need the fourth particle to confirm that Newton's laws are verified. In fact, that isn't true. As Tate showed, you do it with three. So I think that's an interesting thing. And a lot of people have said to me, when they're giving introductory courses in mechanics, they feel very uncomfortable about Newton's first law and how you make objective sense of it. So let me now conclude there, I think, spot on, non-existent time. I conjecture that we should think of instances time as complete configurations of the universe, that duration emerges from a timeless geodesic principle on the configuration space of the universe, and I emphasize this will certainly only work if closed, and I think on Wednesday I'll be able to show that there are some indications that this could work in the relativistic context. I think the idea of internal time is untenable, and I'll conclude by saying the universe is its own unique clock, and it's been kind to me as it's now 5 to 11 Eastern Standard Time. Thank you very much. Should we have the lights on, perhaps, because it's a bit disconcerting talking to the dark. I think Bill was first up, was he, loose in here? Oh, all right, I'll take Bill.
System to do the calculation of what a temperature time was, you'd always get the same answer.
I would put it in a different way. I think the explanation, I mean, you're quite right in pinning down that this is the issue. I would say that the answer is actually in the principle of least action. When you write down the principle of least action for the complete universe, all of the things in the separate systems are contributing to the action, and they've got to be extremal simultaneously, and that's what's matching them up, in my view, Bill. I take the principle of least action as the foundation of this, and geometry. Sure. I mean, yes, that's how the world could be. But I would say if we don't want such unpleasantnesses to happen, let's pin our faith on the principle of least action applying to the complete universe. No. This is the action principle for the whole universe, and division into subsystems is arbitrary. This governs everything. If then it so happens that subsystems, two parts of the universe, get widely separated, so there's virtually no forces acting mutually on across the thing, this will still guarantee that they're separate ephemeris times march in step. It's all in the principle of least action. That's the fundamental principle, which shouldn't be divided into subsystems from the word go. The subsystems emerge under certain fortuitous circumstances. That's how I would put it, and I think that stands up. Sorry, was it? Yes, yeah. The problem of?
Duration,
yes. Yes. Definitely. Yeah, sure. No, it's a very good point that then too that the next clock fails. I would differ from Poincaré. I would put more faith in the principle of least action than the second law of thermodynamics. I would regard it as being a derived thing that is something to do with the total way that the universe works. I have my own ideas about that, but it's due to the asymmetry of the configuration space as the origin of the arrow of time, in my view. But I would certainly put my faith in the principle of least action. It's the only one that can give us a meaningful time, I believe, really, at the dynamical level. That's it. Any more? Yeah. It's very possible that that could be the case. I wouldn't rule out discrete. I personally want to stick with the continuum. This is a prejudice which has been growing within me for at least 20 years, that we shouldn't abandon the continuum too rapidly. But something like that might be possible, but I haven't given any thought to it at all.
Yeah.
You must have sent me an email, isn't it? It's you that, yes, I haven't yet read the content of your paper, but I've got the email, thanks. No, I can't comment on that. Lucen, you better be in case I'm prejudiced. Yeah, I got that, yes. And I knew that before you. I could say several things. First of all, I think any theory must start with something. As King Lear said to his daughter Cordelia, nothing will come of nothing. We have to put something into theory to start with. And I've just come to the conclusion from thinking about these things that you'll get further if you you only need to put in the theoretical foundations, it seems to me, and I agree this is still very much an open issue in relativity, whether that really would stand up to critical examination. But I think certainly from the Newtonian point of view, that's okay. As regards what is more directly observable, as I look at you, Raphael, I see in my mind's eye the width of your head on my retina. I mean, it's there. That's a very direct thing, which is not involving a time as far as I'm concerned. So angles, I would say, are, for me, the most direct and most primitive things that we are aware of. I know there's a lot of processing goes on in our brain, but I think the image on my retina is as close as I get to raw data, and that doesn't involve time, as I see it, at least. Oh, sorry. Beg your pardon? The last word I didn't. Yes, I agree that that's there, but we could still take a snapshot of us, and from our facial expressions, we might be able to do something about the exchange. I would say yes, Lucen, you better.
Just along the previous comments, I think I'm afraid that in your historical examples you used here, you have kind of tautology in the case. And really, I didn't understand what you mean by dynamically closed system. Is conservative system, or what will happen in open system? You know.
I mean a conservative system when I say a dynamically closed system. Yes, I take that there. If it's an open system, in principle, in this way, we will never get a good measure of time. And atomic clocks, of course, have to be, in some senses, dynamically isolated to work properly. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry for not that one, yeah.
I had a question in the same vein as one of the previous questions. From Jacobi's principle, you have this formula for duration, dt, which is written down in terms of dx, v, mass, and e. Well, v you can say is a function of position. Let's assume we can make sense of dx. Mass is internal, but then you still have this e. So it just seems to me like you're replacing time with another continuous parameter, e. So in what sense is e any more internal than the time t, or any less relational?
Well, first of all, you I think that may be partly coming because you come from Newtonian mechanics, where you think of that as energy and measuring how much kinetic energy there is in the system. If you didn't know anything about Newtonian mechanics and just asked for a geodesic principle on the configuration space, that's just a constant that can be there and nothing can stop it. But the interesting thing is that if you insist on scale invariance as well in this Machian thing, that E cannot be there. You can only have the V. So that problem, if we could ever get to a theory which was completely scale invariant in the way I like, that problem would certainly go away. And it also makes me think that that's not a fundamental issue. After all, this E, by the way, plays exactly the same role in Newtonian mechanics as the cosmological constant does in general relativity. And I think most people would think of that, the cosmological constant, as being an expression of the law of nature rather than something to do with the initial condition, although I think you can also think of it, some people think of it that way.
Can you define what open and close means and how would you distinguish in your universe what the difference is?
How do I distinguish between open and closed? For me, the archetypal closed system is n particles in Euclidean space, mass particles obeying Newton's laws for universal gravitation. That's the n-body problem. But in Newtonian theory, particles are assumed to... By the way, all of this goes through perfectly well in field theory as well. This doesn't rely on particles. You can write down perfectly precise expressions for field energies, kinetic and potential, and this whole theory will go through without great problem. The real problem is the universe in some senses finite geometrically, and that's a big assumption. I mean, it could go on forever, and then I would say all bets are off, because we will never know what's going on out there, and we know that what goes on out there is important because of the initial value constraints in general relativity, which are instantaneous laws. You can't send information with them, but they stretch out through the whole universe. This is where I will be absolutely honest. This is where my ideas could very well break down, definitely. That's my conjecture. In fact, we get quite close to seeing this. Astronomers do see, shall we say, three-body systems on the sky, which are at right angles to the line of sight. And then actually, what you see through the telescope is exactly those delta x's in a two-dimensional space. So there are perfectly good cases where this is realized most definitely, and that's just read off from the telescope. And those are literally what the astronomer sees on the sky. So it certainly works. So I think it's a reasonable assumption. I agree that the definition of simultaneity is problematic. I mean, that's an issue. This talk has been about trying to get a theory of duration, which I think has been unjustly ignored.